May it please the court, my name is Beavis Schock. I represent Gregory Clark in this matter. The first issue is a stop by the side of an arrest area in which the officer ran my client, Mr. Clark. I know of no case asserting that a running action, as opposed to just asking for the ID and getting it back, is anything other than a actual seizure. This point does, however, have two parts. The first part is, was he seized? And the second part is, was there reasonable suspicion for the seizure?
And the third part would be whether that was clearly established.
Well, and I'm going to be focusing on the cases, because I think that's where the action is, Your Honor, and I appreciate your thought on that. Let's look at the Palmer case, Supreme Court. You're not free to go. My client takes the position, that when a officer is actually running the subject, that by running I mean calling dispatch and asking and giving the information on the license and all that, you're not free to go, because the officer has the client's, the subject's identification. And the Black case says that taking property is a strong indicator. The Stewart case says it's a show of authority. I assert that that running somebody is a show of authority. So I conclude that there was a seizure in this case. Now, as to whether there was reasonable suspicion to justify the seizure, we have that there were shots fired, allegation of shots fired, and the officers came to the scene. That's obviously very serious and requires a response from the law enforcement. There are children involved. It's very serious. We don't in any way dispute that. What was my client doing? He was in the rest area. 12 minutes later, the officers had to drive 10 miles, do two U-turns, and that, plus the time for the report. He was on the phone. He was doing nothing. When the officers walked up, he could tell they were officers, and he immediately handed over his IDs. Now, there's a case, Doughty, that says the initial response is relevant. His initial response was wholly cooperative. And in fact, he informed the officers by handing the concealed carry card that he had a weapon. He had his retired military ID. These all suggest that he was completely cooperative at the beginning. I draw the court's attention to Walker versus Pine Bluff. That is a case which I assert is spot on in my client's favor and justifies the denial of qualified immunity. In that case, the officers were speaking to a young man, and another person, the subject and the plaintiff in the case, was somewhat nearby. The officers walked up. The young man answered the questions that he was asked, just like my client, and he was cooperative in every way. He was arrested. Qualified immunity was denied. I'd contrast U.S. versus Stewart, which is the district court's case, where the subject was in a car in an area known for robberies, and they were fidgety, and they had a story that didn't match up. When we look at these cases, this story's not matching up becomes important. My client's statements to the officers were wholly consistent with the facts as the officers knew them. Therefore, I believe under the Walker case, qualified immunity should be denied because it really is so close in the facts. Obviously, under the Ziegler case, it has to be beyond debate, Bernicall, clear in light of existing law.
So is it your position that anytime officers request identification, that that's a seizure?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I just draw the distinction. Under Delgado, asking for an ID is not a seizure.
It's the sending for feedback from the department as to...
Correct, because that's the moment when the client can't leave. It's when the officer has shown authority. And the reason he can't leave is he can't leave without his driver's license. He can't abandon all his property.
What about the fact that he volunteered it in this case and they didn't ask for it? Isn't that some suggestion of consent?
Well, I think there's a strong consent for the Delgado interaction. In other words, the consent there is you may know who I am. Mr. Gregory,
could a reasonable officer understand him to be saying, "Here's my ID. Do what you need to do with it"?
Well, I don't think so, because the case law doesn't give the officer that power. Once the officer takes the next step, he has shown that authority. And if we go with the theory that you just approached, Your Honor, then the incentives are all improper for subjects. We want subjects when an officer walks up to say, "How may I help you? Here's my ID. Here's who I am." I mean, these are things which reduce tension, which enable officers to do their job. If suddenly cooperating becomes a way that you are now subject to additional power by the state, I think that would put incentives in the wrong place. If I might go on to the detention at the exit. There are two issues here: avoiding as opposed to fleeing, and provoked and unprovoked. After the interaction with the ID, my client said, "Why did you run me?" The officer said, and he admitted this was not true, but it's something that he did for sort of verbal judo, you might say, "Well, my boss wants to know who I talked to." My client says, "I don't think you would have run me if I were someone else." And then the officer said in a very angry tone, "Don't play the race card with me." And I'll get to that, assuming I have time, when we get to the equal protection claim. And then the officers went into the building at the rest area. They didn't tell him to stay. He didn't rush away. He sat and talked on the phone some more time. His car didn't squeal the tires. He just drove off when the officers had completely disappeared. Surely there's no suspicion from any of that. And then then they come back out and they see he's left and they start following him. Now, the Wardlaw case is the leading case. And it says that headlong flight creates reasonable suspicion. But it also talks about this issue of provoked and unprovoked. I assert my client did not have headlong flight. All he did was avoid. He does go up the ramp. He goes over and goes back south after he had told the gentleman he was going to Chicago. So he's going back the other way. But he can go wherever he wants, right? There's no restriction on where anybody can go. But all that was avoiding. But of great importance is that the officers following him provoked him to make his decision. So that takes the Wardlaw case and makes it in my client's favor. And that is why this going up and over does not entitle the officers to qualified immunity. I draw the court's attention to Liberal versus Estrada, that's a Ninth Circuit case, admittedly, but the subject went around, he didn't violate any laws, but he sort of kept making turns, and then he parks behind a dumpster. And that was found to be not to create reasonable suspicion. The Wong Sun case is a Supreme Court case. That's the one where the officer appears at the Chinese laundry at 6 in the morning and says, "Hey, I have my ticket, I want my laundry." And the subject says, or the owner of the laundry says, "Well, we open at 8, sir, so come back." And then the officer says, "Well, I'm really a policeman." And then Mr. Wong Sung runs to the back. And so the question there is, was it provoked? And the answer was that the conduct of the officer provoked Mr. Wong Sung to run to the back of his place because they had engaged in this ruse. In my case, our case, the plaintiff's case here, the appellant, the action was provoked by the officer following him. Don't forget, it's not just following, but when my client goes up the ramp, at the immediate north exit, they followed him up there.
What were the facts in Wardlaw? Wasn't the officer following the guy? The one where they're walking along in the street and the guy takes off running?
Yeah, I think that's the one where...
Why isn't that the same kind of provocation, the officers?
Oh, it's because of the taking off issue. In other words, there's this idea that the officers come up and the subjects just run in all directions right away. So that's different than my...
Your man crossed over and went back the other way, which could be viewed as an evasive maneuver.
Oh, we absolutely acknowledge that it's an evasive maneuver. But we assert that it is avoiding, which under Wardlaw one may do, as opposed to fleeing, which one may not do. Okay. I mean, the distinction's very strong in the law, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'd like to go to my excessive force claim, if I may. So the excessive force claim...
So what's your point then on the exit ramp? That there was no reasonable suspicion at all at that point to seize him?
Well, that's correct.
Bottom line?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the officer followed him for 19 miles southbound, and then my guy pulled over. In other words, but what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that my client had a right to avoid the police. There had been an uncomfortable interaction. You have a right after you've had an uncomfortable interaction to avoid the police. That's normal human behavior. And he had no obligation to continue north to Chicago. He could go anywhere he wants. I'm going to be very, very brief on this excessive force matter. I've only got 3.5 minutes left. But just to say that, is pointing a gun force? Yes or no is the first question. And the second question is, was the force justified in this case? In this case, my client had his hands out the window of the car. And the officers, his body camera showed in the reflection of the truck that they had their guns up and pointed right at him. And I assert that Shannon versus Kohler from this circuit, that's the one where the ex-cop was in the bar and he was acting in a rambunctious manner, but when he did not in any way threaten anybody, he didn't resist, and the court found that the pointing of the gun was excessive force. I don't give up on my other two claims at the end, but I only have 2 minutes left. If I may, I'd like to reserve my time if the court doesn't have any questions. Thank you.
I see none. Ms. Kaser?
May it please the court. My name is Portia Kaiser. I represent the appellee, Detective Austin Clark, in this action. This is an appeal from the granting of a summary judgment, and I think that's important because what we're looking at really is not a dispute about facts here. We're talking about a question of law. Summary judgment was filed at the conclusion and close of all discovery in this case, and the district court took the case as properly briefed and reviewed those facts. But as this court said in 2001 in Lamka versus Sorrell, once the predicate facts have been established in a law enforcement 1983 case, the reasonableness of the officer's conduct is a question of law. And as a question of law, it is appropriate to be decided upon summary judgment.
Counsel, would you pull the mic down just a little bit?
Yes. Sorry, I'm very short. Here it's a question of qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is best described in Malley versus Briggs, where the Supreme Court said that qualified immunity protects all but the plainly incompetent or the ones who are knowingly violating the law, and that there is no cause of action for bad guesses in gray areas, but rather only liability if there is a transgression of a bright line. On January 25th, 2016, Detective Clark did his job. He investigated a call related to a shooting at an elementary school. He responded and had some interactions with the appellant on that day. The appellant raises 5 points in his brief, the first of which being the initial encounter. The initial encounter was nothing but a consensual encounter, Your Honors. The case law that is cited by the appellant and that he spoke with you at length about, especially U.S. versus Stewart, which was an Eighth Circuit case, actually, Judge Colleton, you wrote the opinion in Stewart, I believe, had to do with a truck that was parked in a sketchy area. Nobody had done anything wrong in that truck, but the officer came up behind it, turned on his lights, went to the window, took the gentleman's identification, talked to him. He said he was trying to have an affair. There were some oddities there. But he took that identification. He went back to his car, just like a police officer would if they had actually pulled you over, went to his car, ran the identification, ran the license plate, and came back. But this court held that that entire encounter was consensual until the time that the officer asked the gentleman to get out of the car. When Stewart was asked to get out of the car because the officer, upon running the identification, found that he had an outstanding warrant, then it became a seizure. Only when there is a seizure is the Fourth Amendment even implicated. If you can run the identification with a case like Stewart, you can certainly run the identification in a case like
this. Counsel, what would have been the reasonable suspicion to continue to for the second seizure, or what could be described as the second encounter?
The second encounter at the off ramp.
Right. If the first encounter was innocent, just simple investigation, just finding out who this person is, why wasn't he free to go?
He was free to go, Your Honor.
Well, then what created the new basis for a stop?
So we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. This court in U.S. v. Quinn stated that separating out individual factors is fatal to an appellant's claim. The totality of the circumstances here show from the beginning that there were oddities that built upon each other. The appellant wants you to look solely at the fact that he turned around and that this was either provoked or unprovoked. All of that is irrelevant.
You said we look at the totality.
It is a totality of
circumstances. So why would those things be irrelevant?
Well, provoked versus unprovoked flight, the cases that he cited to only have to do with whether or not that provoked or unprovoked flight were standing alone can create a reasonable suspicion. And that's why I say it's not relevant, because all of those cases are asking, if I ran from you because I'm trying to avoid you, can that standing alone equal reasonable suspicion?
Okay, all right, I understand. Why don't you go back to what in the totality established reasonable suspicion?
Thank you. We start at the very beginning. So Terry versus Ohio notes that that there are going to be times when innocent people are questioned. It's just a fact of life. But that's what Terry acknowledges expressly. Terry says if you don't have enough facts upon talking to somebody to create probable cause, then that person has to be free to go,
give the police the license to follow you until you do something suspicious enough for them to stop you again.
I understand, Your Honor. Here's how the facts played out. And really, there's no dispute about what happened between the appellant and Detective Clark. Detective Clark received a call that there was a shooting in the vicinity of a school. That shooting was reported to come from a wooded area between a rest stop and the school property. When they responded to that location, the appellant was there. Not only was he the only individual present at the stop that they could visually see, not the only car, but the only person they could visually see, he was seated directly at the edge of the woods, right where the shots were alleged to have been fired. When they came up and spoke with him, he admitted that he was armed with a weapon. They ran his identification, they returned it to him, they left to continue their investigation. What struck them as strange after that point was, number one, Detective Clark's experience in dealing with former military members was that they're usually very helpful. It was very strange to him when he came out that the appellant left the scene. To Austin Clark, he believed that the appellant left in an urgent manner.
What help was he going to provide? He wasn't a police officer.
He was not a police officer.
Looking for a suspect. He provided the help that he could by giving them accurate information.
He did. The issue for Detective Clark, though, is that in his training and his experience as a law enforcement officer, he had not seen people leaving the scene of an investigation that was into a serious crime, like shooting at a school district, without making any further contact with the law enforcement. He wasn't required to. But Terry says even an accumulation of innocent acts can result in reasonable suspicion. Because Detective Clark believed that the leaving was an oddity and that the appellant left urgently, in his opinion, they followed. They had been told he was going to Chicago.
Was he speeding?
He was not. He was not.
Well, what turned it into urgency?
That's how Detective Clark, in his experience, believed he was leaving. It was a very odd situation for somebody to leave when you're walking around asking questions. Not only because...
Well, once the officers have asked you questions and they get up and move away, are you obligated to wait for them to tell you you're free to leave? I thought that you weren't being seized. So when the officer turns their back and starts to walk away, you're free to go.
Yes. What I'm saying is not that what he did wasn't innocent. I'm saying that it raised suspicions.
Was it a reasonable suspicion? Was it articulable? You know, because you're talking about reasonable suspicion. You have to always remember, it must tie to some criminal act. What's the criminal act? He got up and left. Tell me how that act points towards a reasonable suspicion that a crime is afoot.
The reasonable suspicion starts at the very beginning of this encounter, with all of the things that had led up to the point when they
right.
walked
away. Right, but listen, you have a shooting.
Sure.
It's at least 12 minutes old. You know, it's reasonable to think that guys don't just shoot and just hang around, generally speaking. So you go to a place where 12 minutes ago we suspect shots were fired. We see a gentleman sitting at a table on the phone. You go and approach him. You talk to him. Nothing wrong with that. He hands you his ID. You know at this point, retired military, who he is, and he has a concealed carry permit. Now, you never ask him politely, do you have your gun on you? May we see the gun? All those things, which could have been done just in an ordinary course, right? None of those questions are asked. Instead, it turns into this conversation where there's a really kind of an inappropriate conversation at the end. And then you say it's suspicious because the person who feels that he's been singled out because of his race, and the feedback's not entirely positive, didn't hang around to get permission to leave. And you say, that's suspicious. And I'm saying, okay, it's suspicious. Like, to what crime? How does it tie together?
Sure. It all ties back to what they're investigating. Because they had come to him, they had asked him, they now know he's armed, they know he was in the vicinity, they don't have probable cause to stop him at that point. But when they come out from the rest area and they see that he's left, the Supreme Court in Hernandez versus Mesa says you have to look to what the officer's training was. What did the officer know? It is relevant what he believes is unusual. So along with all of the peculiarities up to that point, now we have a gentleman who, in Detective Clark's experience, would normally not be leaving the site of an investigation, not that he wasn't allowed to. Innocent acts under Terry versus Ohio can still create a reasonable suspicion. They decided to follow him to see if he was fleeing for some reason. Upon coming onto the freeway behind him, where he's headed north, the direction he said he was headed, he then exits the freeway and starts going back in the opposite direction. That's another curiosity, another suspicion that is raised. Why would somebody who has told us at the stop that they're headed to Chicago now is turning around after leaving in that direction, which seems reasonable, but now all of a sudden they're going in the exact opposite direction that they've told us. Following that, as they're following the appellant, Detective Clark says he could see inside of the vehicle that the appellant was moving around more than what would be if you're going to grab something, looking at, as he described it in his deposition, as an excessive amount of movement. And then this gentleman pulls over by himself on a rest stop or at an exit ramp. All of that built to the point where a seizure under Terry was appropriate, and they had reasonable suspicion based upon the totality of all of those circumstances to, in fact, stop and investigate. Detective Clark had reasonable suspicion to stop the appellant and investigate further to see whether or not that gun had been fired.
Is the different reasonable suspicion for the second stop than the first?
Changing direction, movement in the truck, and leaving the rest stop. Those are the three things that raised Detective Clark's suspicion. And then pulling over by yourself. He wasn't pulled over. He admits that he voluntarily pulled
over. How many police cars were a part of this?
Detective Clark was the only one following, but he had called for backup. I believe there were one or two other cars in the vicinity that came up on it. But when we look at everything that Officer Clark was dealing with and evaluating and trying to find what the appellant agrees is a very serious crime, trying to find if this individual had something to do with it, all of that was reasonable under Terry and under Hodari and Mildenhall and Stewart. All of these were justified reasons to stop him. When we get to the stop, Officer Clark, or Detective Clark, knowing that the appellant is armed, did draw his weapon and have it in a low-ready position. That low-ready position is shown on his body cam. Detective Clark does not believe he ever raised the gun. However, when he was opening the door, it appears that it may have raised. The district court noted that in their opinion. But the real issue here is that the black letter law in the Eighth Circuit is that raising a gun, pointing it without the intent or an attempt to shoot, does not violate an individual's constitutional rights. This is not a clearly established right. The appellant points us to Shannon versus Keller, which says generally that a suspect is free from, should be free from excessive force in the context of an arrest. However, Shannon goes on to say, that's not enough. It's a great general principle, but you have to actually have a clearly defined contour of what the officer is doing and whether or not that is something that has been deemed illegal. And in the Eighth Circuit, it's not. We have a case. The black letter law is that raising a gun, pointing a gun, is not excessive force. It was an older decision, but it's been cited as recently as 2016 and 2014 in Brown versus Moore, citing to Edwards as the case that is applicable in the Eighth Circuit. The fact that, Your Honors, I see my time has expired. Thank you very much for your time. We are asking that you affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Kaiser. Mr. Schock, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of quick things. The first thing is that in that Stewart, U.S. versus Stewart, the plaintiff
did not write, by the way. Judge Grunder wrote it, so
yeah.
It might be better for the appellee, since I didn't write it. Go ahead.
In that case, there was no challenge to the taking and running of the license. I mean, I guess I just read it differently, but I mean, I read it yesterday on this question, and there's no allegation in that case that the court discussed whether running the officer constituted a seizure. Apparently, the plaintiff didn't make the argument. That's how I read it. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to say just a couple of other things. One is that I think it's, of course, well-established law that this matter has to be viewed from my client's perspective at this time. He says, the back of my truck was tinted. You can't see anybody move around in a tent in it with a tinted window. Further, what would that mean? That the officers already knew he had a gun. I mean, what are they suspicious about? They already know he's got the gun. So that doesn't seem to add anything to me.
Do they know he has a gun, or only know that he has a permit to have one?
Well, that's a good question. I guess they didn't say. And I would say the common way the officers do the gun business with the concealed carry is they say, may I remove your gun, sir? Because they don't want the subject to pull his gun out of his own holster, because he'll plug him if he chooses to. They say, raise your arms, and then they take the weapon away. Is how it's done. It's my understanding. My co-counsel is an ex-policeman. I think he would support that. But on that,
why couldn't they be legitimately investigating the shooting by checking out his gun?
Oh, I think they could have asked him, sir, would you mind if we smelled your gun? I think they could have done that, absolutely. In fact, that's how the thing ended.
That could have happened at the rest stop.
I think so, yes.
But since he left, why couldn't they do it later?
Well, I think it's the point of Judge Erickson, which is it's over at that point.
Why is it over? They still haven't figured out who was the shooter.
Well, because they're not investigating. What they're doing at that point is targeting my client. I mean, this is a response, I believe, to the argument. That's what's driving this conduct at the second stop. They're targeting my guy because of the argument.
What's the proof of that?
Well, it's the totality of the... I mean, it's something that's for the jury. Causality, great question. That goes to my fourth argument, which is the equal protection argument. Causality is for the jury. We certainly have the fact that the argument occurred, and we have that there's nothing else.
Well,
thank
that's
you,
not
Your Honors.
Proof.
I'm sorry?
It's not proof.
Well, but it's... I think it's enough to take it to the jury. That's my argument. Thank you. Sir.
Thank you.
No more questions.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks all counsel for your presence and the arguments you provided to us, the briefing. We'll take the case under advisement.